Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsible day for the 8th of Tishrei. Today we're going to do something a little different. We do it every so often, which is where I'm going to take a particular respondent in our situation, the Chatam Sofer, and note three relatively brief responses of his, all of them which occurred on the 8th of Tishrei, meaning I didn't find any particular response that caught my eye to do one long response. And here are three very interesting ideas the Chatam Sofer shares on different dates in his life on the 8th of Tishrei. So we'll get to, in some sense, sort of know how he spent the 8th of Tishrei at least three different times in his life. The first is from Shur Chatam Sofer. It's actually printed in Chelek Dalet, which is Eben Ezra Chelek Bet, Siman Kuf Yud Gimel, response number 113 in the fourth volume. And he's writing back to Rav Elazar Lando Segel, who I think must have been a descendant of the Rabbi Yehuda, but he doesn't say it in the Tshuva. He got a letter from Munkach, which included a response of this, Rav Elazar Lando Segel's, who had said, who was talking about a chalitza sandal. So the problems with the chalitza sandal. Chalitza, let's remember, is, God forbid, if a man passes away without any children and his wife, his widow, needs to either do Yibum or Chalitza with one of his brothers. Yibum would be she married the brother. We don't any longer, Ashkenazim certainly don't do that any longer. I think some Sephardim still do it, but Ashkenazim did not. So therefore, her only option was Chalitza. So she needs a Chalitza. And what you need to do is she takes a shoe off of the intended brother, husband, and she spits in his presence, and she says, this man refuses to marry me, and you have a whole ceremony. So the definition of the shoe, there were certain rules for what qualified as a shoe or not. So this, Rabbi Elazar Lando Segel had asked people to send his ideas to the Chasam Sofer to react. Chasam Sofer is now reacting. And he had previously written a tshuva about this issue, and he, in his previous tshuva, had said that when there's a commentary on Masechet Shabbat, who says the sandal has to be of two pieces, and the Chasam Sofer had written that he doesn't understand the proof and that he thinks that the important piece for a chalitza shoe is the underneath piece. So this was Segel that sent him his ideas about this, and the Chasam Sofer says, well, I understood your proof already, whatever it was, it's a little technical for us, but he says, I think that a sandal is like the ma'aberta of tefillin. When men put on tefillin, there's one piece of leather that goes through a loop in the other, and that's what puts it all together. And so he thinks that's what you did with the chalitza sandal. You would put a loop of leather through to the bottom of a piece, and then you would either sew it in or nail it in on the second side. And that's what would make the loops of the sandal to hold it together. So that he, and the Chasam Sofer says, the fewer sewings that you have, the better it is, because you don't want it to come loose. And the less opportunities, the less openings there are. So you want to do as much as you can, as much of it can be in one piece as possible, so there's no openings for it to get loose, the better it would be. On that issue, this Rabbi Elazar Lando Segel had held that it was the top piece that we're worried about, and the Chasam Sofer disagrees. He says in Shabbos terms, that's true. In Shabbos terms, because what we're worried about is if a woman's wearing a certain kind of a shoe and it comes loose, people will notice it, and then she'll be upset about it. And so there's some concern about whether she should wear certain things on Shabbos, because we're worried that if something goes wrong with them, she will end up taking it off and maybe carrying it in a place she's not allowed to carry on Shabbat, and that'll be a problem. But the Chasam Sofer says, in terms of a sandal for our purposes for chalitza, it's clear that it's the sewing part where you sew it on the top part onto the bottom part that will hold it together, because if the things come apart, that's where the problem is. He also says he thinks that for our chalitza purposes, the important part of a shoe, for chalitza purposes, the important part of a shoe, meaning on Shabbos, there's also the element of other people seeing her and the social element. But in chalitza purposes, the essential element is the bottom of the shoe, because what makes a shoe is that it protects us from walking on bare ground and all whatever things might be in the ground, right? If there's a stone in the ground or there's glass on the ground or whatever there might be, that's the primary reason we wear shoes, is to stop our feet from coming into contact with that and therefore being hurt by those things. If that's true, then he thinks it's clearly true that the essential part of protection of the shoe is the bottom, and that's the part that we have to make sure holds together. And then just the very closing of the tshuva, it's a very short response, but it's, I understand, fairly technical, because A, we don't have a lot of chalitza today, and B, we don't want to have a lot of chalitza today, because we'd prefer that people live to have children, that we prefer people live long lives, and certainly to have children, and therefore never have a problem with chalitza. So in this context, he does, however, note that there are four ways. Sorry, it's going to be in a later tshuva. There's some discussion here of sewing. He won't bring it up here. In a later tshuva that we'll see later today, he's going to talk about the different ways that we can combine things to put things back together, and we'll get to that then. So that's the first tshuva, a relatively I don't want to say minor, but a matter of concern only to those involved in that particular halachic issue, but it is from the 8th of Tishrei on Tuf Kuf Ayin Gimel of 1812, right? The 8th of Tishrei of 1812, and that's the tshuva that he wrote. The next tshuva has much more broader ramifications for our purposes, and this is discussion of from the 8th of Tishrei of Tuf Kuf Tzadi Bet of 1831. He discussed, let's say you have a situation where there was a plague, as there used to be in, I mean, there still are plagues today, but there certainly used to be plagues back in the 19th century, and there was a plague, and so a relative passed away, but because the plague was so pressing, there wasn't time to sit and mourn and to observe Shiva. Right, because everybody was afraid of the plague, and they said they were going to visit each other, and people were doing whatever they were doing, and there was no time or opening to mourn. The question was, let's say the plague stops within 30 days of the passing of the person passed away. If it's longer than 30 days, that's like a shmua rechoka. It's like a far-off occurrence already, and then we wouldn't any longer have the ability to do a full mourning for the person. But let's suppose that the plague ends within 30 days of the person passing away. So there was a report. Sorry, before we get to the report, the Chasam Sofer says he holds, yes, that you have to mourn fully. So it would be like a full Shiva and Shloshim in full mourning in that situation. And he reports that there was another Rav from Prague, Rav Shimon, I think Shapira from Prague, who held. Our situation was there was a plague, and therefore there was just a lot of pressing issues, and people didn't have the opening to mourn. His case was, let's say if somebody was ill at the time that the relative passes away, but gets better within Shlosh, I mean, thinks that person would then have to sit shiv, which is an interesting thing. Let's suppose, you know, God forbid, somebody's in the hospital, and one of their relatives passes away, and they're in the hospital in a way that there's no meaningful way in which they can mourn, and they can observe Shiva. If they get out of the hospital a week or two later, and they're now fine and able to mourn, then they have to mourn. This is what the Maharaj Shapira held in Prague. They would have to then mourn fully a full Shiva. And he had pointed out that there was a debate about another issue. Let's suppose, sadly, a minor, you know, a girl who's not yet 12 and a boy who's not yet 13 lost a relative. So they're not obligated in Avelos because they're children. So they don't fulfill mitzvahs, really. So let's suppose that we today will do various things in that situation. But let's suppose the child reaches the age of majority, bar or bat mitzvah, within shloshim of the passing. So that was a debate in the time, in the time of the Rishon. And the Maharam had held that the child would, who now an adult, would have to observe Shiva in shloshim. And the Rush had held, who was a student of the Maharams, but the Rush had held that it's not true, that we don't follow that halacha, and that the child, because the Avelos occurred at a time when the child was not obligated in mitzvos, child is not obligated in the Avelos. So far already, within the Avelos question, we've got three variations of the same issue. If somebody cannot mourn for some reason at the moment when Avelos starts, what is their status later on if they can then mourn? So the furthest case was they're not obligated in mourning at all at the moment of the Avelos happening. That's a debate between the Rush and the Maharam of Wittenberg. The Maharam of Wittenberg thought if they reached the age of majority within Shloshim, they would then fast. The Rush disagreed. Let's suppose that it's an adult that is a fully obligated person, but who is ill at the moment of the death of the relative, and therefore cannot mourn. So there, this Maharaj Shapira from Prague had held, it's clear that if they get better, they should then, within a shloshim, they then need to perform to observe Shiva and shloshim. The Chasam Sofer is saying, and let's suppose it wasn't a question of being ill, it was a question of there was just something going on in the world. Another example would be war, but his example was plague, such that they couldn't mourn it anyway. If within shloshim they were then able to, they would, within the 30-day period after the person passed away, they would then have to mourn. That's Chasam Sofer's conclusion. He thinks that's correct and true. But he adds, but it's also true, he says, that if a holiday happened during that time, in between, that the holiday would stop it. This is based on the general halacha, that holidays stop avilut. So for example, if somebody loses a relative, God forbid, just before Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, that we, or Rosh Sukkot or Pesach or Shavuot, we think that if they've set some Shiva before the holiday ends Shiva. If they've set a full Shiva before the holiday, the holiday will then end Shloshim. Because we hold that holidays end the period of mourning. That's if the extreme example of that is if sadly somebody loses a relative Erev Yom Kippur and they bury the person that day and they sit a little bit of Shiva. I'm sorry, and they sit a little bit of Shiva. Then the Yom Kippur will end the Shiva, and Sukkot will end the Shloshim 5 days later. So those people, there are always people who have something along these lines, and those people have an extremely abbreviated halachic period of mourning for their relative. How they handle psychologically the feelings they're going through, that's also an important question, but that's not the technical halachic question. In terms of halachic obligations to mark the passing of a close relative, that would be what they were required. So here, requires or assumes that the mourner has begun mourning and the regel and the holiday then comes and stops it, right? Puts an end to it. But here the Chasam Sofer is saying if for some reason the person was unable to mourn, to act with these acts of mourning, and then a holiday came, the holiday would interrupt the mourning even though they hadn't done any mourning whatsoever. And he gets that, he says, in Moed Katan, Daf Chaf Amin Aleph, we say that if somebody did one morning practice, in their times the morning practice was kfiyat hamita, which was turning over the mattress and sleeping on probably on a lower bed than usual. If they had done that, then the regel, then the holiday stops the morning. The Ravid inferred from that, that's only if one had acted in some kind of active way, an active mourning that a regular holiday can interrupt. But if the person didn't do any acts of mourning, the Ravid had held, whether or not it was on purpose. So if he did it on purpose, he said, I'm not interested in mourning. And then the regal came. We can understand why we would say the regal, the holiday, doesn't interrupt the mourning. But let's say the person is a shogeg, they just didn't realize. Right? They knew the relative passed away. They were sad, but they didn't realize that part of expressing one's sadness halakhically over the passing of a relative is sitting on the floor or not wearing shoes or whatever the practices may be. So they're a shogeg. So you might have thought that there maybe the holiday would do it. The Ravid held it not true. The Ravid held that unless one has done some act of mourning, the regel doesn't come in. And the Ravid writes, Shelo yehei chote niskar. That you don't want, and this is a general halachic concern, we don't want people who commit sins to then be rewarded for their sins. Here's this person sinned by not observing regel, the person, not the person in the original response of that Chasam Sofer is addressing, the person in the Ravid's case who has not observed mourning either on purpose, deliberately, or bishogig without realizing what he was doing in whatever way. Nonetheless, we don't want benefit to accrue from the failure to observe that which they were required to observe. But if they had started mourning, then the regel would interrupt it. And when the Ravid says that the person who did not observe it would have to, after the holiday, observe it, the Ravid does agree, avalo yikra, that person would not, however, tear kriya, rend one's clothing, because we only tear kriya bishat chimum. We only tear kriya, as we saw just, I think, yesterday in the Shivat Sdei Eliezer, we only tear kriya, we only rend our clothing when we are in the most active phases of grief over the person has passed away. So another example of that, the Chasam Sofer points out, would be, let's say somebody didn't have any clothing to rent. They were wearing borrowed clothing. They don't have any clothing of their own. They're very poor. You can't tear somebody else's clothing because you hear that a relative has passed away. And let's suppose that person doesn't get any of their own clothing until after the period of Shiva. So he would, once he got clothing of his own, he would tear. But if it was after Shiva, then it's not the shat chimum. I'm sorry. So if he gets the clothing within Shiva, he would tear. But after Shiva, he wouldn't tear because it's not considered shat chimum anymore. That, by the way, is one of the ways in a completely unrelated discussion. But there is a halacha that one is, at least in theory, supposed to tear clothing when one sees the ruins of Jerusalem and the cities of Yehuda and the place of the Beit HaMikdash and the place of that we used to have the Beit HaMikdash, that one would have to tear kriya. There's a question today about whether it applies to Ari Yehuda, since they're, thank God, no longer desolate in the ways they were in the times of the Gemara. There's some question about that issue, but certainly, let's say, the ruins of the Beit HaMikdash are still ruined. There's still no Beit HaMikdash there. So one answer would be to tear kriya. And I know people who have torn their clothing in this situation, but let's people don't want to tear their clothing, so, and they haven't been to the area within 30 days, so there are a couple of ways out of it that people have, halachic workarounds. So one is to only go the first time, to go on Shabbos, because one doesn't dare a kriya on Shabbos or a holiday, and then when one goes after that, then they've already seen it, and it hasn't had the same effect. And another one that I learned years and years ago, people say, well, you know, be makne your clothing. give your clothing, even while they're on you, you can do an act of acquisition on your clothing to somebody else, and then you don't have the right to tear because it's not your clothing. That's what's coming up here. So that situation, the kriya has to happen b'shas kima, the rabbi had said, and if it only happens that you get clothing of your own after shiva, that wouldn't be b'shas kima anymore. Now the Rosh and the Mordechai and the two of the Shulchan Aruch all cited that rabbi, that claim, that if one has not observed mourning properly, even if it was not fully deliberate, especially if it was fully deliberate, we would require them to observe it later, even if a regel had happened in between. So the Chassid Sofer says, but you see that theoretically, the regel, the holiday, stops Avelus. Here it's only because he's got this reason of, you don't want a chote to biniska, you don't want a sinful person, even if they sinned unknowingly without full knowledge, but you don't want a sinning person to gain benefit from the sin. And that's why even a shogeg, he thinks, has to go back and observe the mourning, because even in a shogeg case where the person didn't fully know what was going on, there's some blame that attaches to that. There's some neglect in terms of not realizing or not knowing that the halacha is that people have to mourn in certain situations. So however it is, we generally in halacha, and this is less well known today than maybe it should be, we generally in halacha do not think of a shogeg as completely blame-free. They're certainly not amazing. They're certainly not doing it deliberately, willfully, or evilly. But there's some issues with a shogeg as well, and therefore that would be why the rabbi said that. But when it comes to an ones, somebody who was beyond their power to mourn, says the Sitz Eliezer, so that shouldn't be the same as the Ravid situation. Now the Ravid didn't mention ones. He didn't mention ones without the holiday happening or ones with the holiday happening. The Ravid didn't mention any of that. And that's why the Ma'arash held that an ones without a holiday, so you've got that debate between the Rosh and the Mordechai, the Maran Baruch, about whether a child should do it, and he thought that in the case of ones, even the Rosh would agree that you have to. And the Chassid Sofer is saying that he thinks so in that situation, if there was a regel in between, that the ones, the fact that it was beyond their power to mourn, the holiday would then interrupt the mourning, and they would be able to, and they would not have to mourn after the holiday. And as support for this, he notes that there was the Mordechai quotes in Maharam Me'Angleterre, which is England, who wondered about the following situation. Let's suppose somebody hears about a relative who had passed away within 30 days of the passing, but they hear it on day 29. And day 29 is Shabbos, so you're not allowed to mourn on Shabbos, and that night is a holiday. So the person will not have observed mourning, but it's not because he's a shogeg, it's not because he didn't know he was supposed to mourn, and it's not because he on purpose didn't mourn. Question is, does the holiday do it? And so this Maharam of England had held and inferred from the Maharam of Wittenberg that was the question. And Maharam of Wittenberg had quoted this Rebbe and said it's got to be only the Rebbe was talking about where the person violated the Torah or violated halacha by not mourning. But where the person had no ability to mourn, so there, and it's halacha that's stopping this person from mourning on that Shabbos, so therefore he thinks the holiday would stop it there. And that is where the Chasam Sofer comes out on this question. He thinks that, and this is for the 8th of Tishrei of Tav Kuf Tzadi Bet of 1831, he comes out thinking that in the situation of plague or other matters beyond one's control, if within 30 days there's the opportunity to mourn, the people have the obligation to mourn fully, a shiva, like a full shiva in Shloshim, but if a holiday happens in between, that will interrupt it, and therefore they won't be obligated to mourn in that situation. I neglected to point out that in each of these tshuvot, in the coming one as well, it's the 8th of Tishrei, so it's a Seres Yimei Tshuva, it's just before Yom Kippur, and each of them, Chassid Sofer makes sure to wish people well, and that they should be sealed with a good life and a good and all the good blessings. And I need to notice that, remember that, because when I record these things, I also sometimes forget to express my good wishes to all those who do me the great favor of joining me in studying these issues together. And I wish you a Gemar Chatima Tova, and that the year should be a wonderful year with all the good things that we all want, and we find our ways, all of us, to our best selves, and to doing that which HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants of us all the time. So with that, we can look at the third tshuva that he wrote, that I found, of the Chassam Sofer's on the 8th of Tishrei. This one is from the 8th of Tishrei of Tav Kuf Tzadi Tet of 1838. And the question starts, it sounded like a little technical. Somebody's lulav broke a little bit, and the top part of it broke off. And now what's left And the top part broke up. You need the top to a lulav. And it's not enough to be a shear, to be the right amount of a lulav. And the question is, can you put it back together with the leftover lulav? And which has not been completely ruined, and there's a little bit of a connection between the two parts. So the top of the lulav is mostly broken off, and it's a little bit connected enough that the Mishnah in Uksin spoke about connection of branches in terms of a te'inash nifshach. So that's a Mishnah in Uksin Gimel Chet 3:8. Chachamim held there that if a piece of a branch is broken off to a large extent, but enough that if we leave it or we tie it just so that it doesn't break off further, it will grow back or it will produce fruit. And in that sense, it's still connected. Then we can still consider it connected to the original tree, which is in the ground. And then there won't be tumah entire issues. There won't be issues of ritual purity and impurity. So that's what this person writing the question had said, that he thinks it fits that standard of still being connected. That's a reminder for all of us. For most of us, we're not, broad Gedolei Torah. We're not those who are widely familiar with all of Torah and all of its ramifications. It's a reminder that there often arise issues in halacha which seem like ordinary issues. You know, what kind of lulav can you use on sukkahs? And that are connected to, the questions that come up with them are connected to areas of halacha that many of us leave for, the experts, leave for those who choose to delve into the esoteric. And sometimes the esoteric, not just sometimes, more often than you notice, the esoteric is important and relevant to the ordinary, and therefore it's not really esoteric. So here too, you have a lulav that broke off, and the standard for whether it's broken off or not maybe should be the same standard as we see in issues of tumah and tara, a ritual purity and impurity. And in fact, Chazon Sofer says that if it's that connected, then yeah, I think you're fine, because that counts as being connected. Even though you looked at it, if you looked at it just with your ordinary human eyes, it would look like it's, hanging on by a thread, as it were. As long as that thread is such that were it on a tree, it would be enough to continue giving it nutrition and letting it grow and thrive on, then that's considered connected, and therefore we don't have a problem. But if it's not that connected, Chazon Sofer says he doesn't think there's any way to fix it. And that's true on the first day of Sukkot, which is a more significant day because the obligation is from Torah law, and there's all sorts of restrictions on the first day that don't apply to the rest of the days in terms of it being Hadar, being particularly beautiful, being his and his alone, not bringing somebody else, and all sorts of things like that. But the Chazon Sofer, says he thinks it's not even valid on the rest of Sukkot when the obligation is rabbinic. And you might have thought there would be lower standards, because there are lower standards for other things. In other words, for the definition of what's considered a beautiful lulav or etrog, or what's considered too dried out, those standards change from day one to day two and the beyond days. So here, Chazon Sofer says you didn't think it helped, because once the top is off, then the bottom isn't a lulav anymore. It's just like a piece of, it's like a palm stick. It's a stick that used to be on a lulav tree, but it's not a lulav tree. It's not a lulav itself anymore, and therefore tying it on won't do anything for us. And he says, we're talking about tying as being valid in halacha. That's true in tzitzis issues, and it might be true. There's those who hold that it's true on the straps of tefillin. But that's because when you tie it back on, the original was also fulfilling its purpose in that mitzvah. It's just that it didn't have the right shear. It didn't have the right length. But with a lulav, a small lulav, if I take a small lulav and I tie it onto something else, it's just a stick. So that's a nothing. And therefore, to say that will make it into a shear, that doesn't make any sense. So notice that the Chazon Sofer is holding that once the top breaks off this lulav, then the leftover is not, it's not that the leftover is a broken lulav or a lulav without the right length to it. It's not anything. And that's the fundamental underlying point of his claim here, that there's no way to help it. Then he gets into this digression that I mentioned before in the first of the Tshuvot, where here he talks about the different ways we have in halacha of putting things back together. One is sewing, tefirah, and that's the best. So we saw that in the chalitz issue, that you're going to have tefirah, but even there, you wanted to have as little of it as possible because you're worried about it breaking apart. But that's the best because it makes two things that are separate into one unit. So he could have mentioned the chalitz issue, but he doesn't here. He points out that we tie Sifrei Torah together. When we have, the way we write Sifrei Torah, when we write Torah scrolls, we take pieces of parchment. We don't take a piece of parchment long enough for a whole Torah. We take much smaller pieces of parchment. The sofer writes on them, and then they combine them together by sewing them to each other. So that process, he says, you see that sewing really unites something. So that would mean, although he's not going to bring it up here, but theoretically, if one could sew the lulav back together, although there is no such thing, if one could sew the lulav back together, maybe that would have been okay. But you can't do such a thing, and therefore you can't do it. A little bit less good than that in terms of connecting things is gluing things together. So it happens to be that the scribes, the sofrim in Poland, would glue together the leather of the tefillin. Some tie it together, and the Chasam Sofer had a discussion of that elsewhere, but gluing it also puts things together in a slightly less good way than sewing, but it unites things. Tying kishira, like on tzitzis, if a tzitzis breaks, you want to tie it back on. So some hold that's okay. The Magen Avraham says it's okay lechatchila, and with ritzuos, with the straps of tefillin, it's a debate. But that's a tying together. But in that tying, it's clear they don't become one. It's just they might be so well tied together that we can treat them as one, right? If you tie two tzitzis strings together, you don't think it's one string. It's two strings tied together, but you might think that the tie is sufficient that allows us to treat it as one long string for halakhic purposes, just saying we have enough of a shear now. And then the last way to put things together is an egget. So an egget is you don't tie the two things together. You take an external tie and you put it around them. So the prime example of that would be when we take the three minimum of the lulav and we tie them together, and then we put the etro with it. So that tying together, that's not tying pieces of hadasim and aravos to the lulav. It's taking something and uniting together into one bigger unit, but each of the things is clearly its own thing. We also do it, let's say, with when you're going to sprinkle mitzvah water, you need to take an agudat hezov and you tie those together as well. So that's a fourth way to unify things. And that way is clearly the least unifying because it takes the separate items and it puts them into a bigger unit, but they're still each their own independent thing. The very last piece of this tshuva has a discussion of, let's suppose a non-Jew says, these fruit that I'm selling now, they're from the second year of the tree, and they're very good. They're very, and that's why he's saying they're the best. They're from the second year of the tree. And a Jew takes it, doesn't know that there's an issue of orla. There's an issue of fruit that grows in the first 3 years of the tree. We're supposed to not use it. We're supposed to burn it. So part of the underlying complications here is that orla in Israel that belongs to a Jew, the tree that belongs to a Jew, that's the most serious form of orla. Once it's outside of Israel, it becomes less serious in the sense that the halacha is that if we have a suffix about it, if we're not sure if it's orla, we're allowed to ignore the suffix. In Eretz Israel, in Israel, we're not allowed to ignore that suffix, but outside of Israel, we are. And then some held that if the orla comes off of a non-Jew's tree, it was always owned by a non-Jew, that it doesn't qualify as orla as well. So all of those issues come up here because they might seem to be avenues to leniency. Now, it happens to be there's a Gemara in Yevamos, where a bright in Yevamos, where it says that if a non-Jew claims these fruit are orla fruit, we don't have to believe the non-Jew, and we say he's lying to try to make his produce seem better. So that would suggest that even in Israel, if we have a suffix, it's usher. Here, we wouldn't have a suffix, we wouldn't even have a doubt, because we're allowed to say we can ignore what the non-Jew is claiming, because he's just claiming because he thinks it'll make his fruit more valuable and people more likely to buy it. But in our situation, since the Jew who bought it from the non-Jew bought it believing that it was orla, although he didn't know that orla was a problem, he believed that it was the second year of the fruit, he didn't realize that orla is an issue, so now he comes to ask his rabbi, what's he allowed to do with these fruit that he has now mixed with lots and lots of other fruit? It's become a big deal financially for him to forego these fruit. So we might say what's called shavya anafshe chaticha di isur. We have a halachic principle that when people believe something for themselves, they might have to treat it as prohibited, even if halachically there's not enough evidence for us to say it has to be so. If I believe something, even if halacha tells me that I'm not required to believe, but I've already believed it internally, then I might have to treat it as if it's prohibited to me as well. So maybe you'd have to do this thing here. So the problem with that, the Chasam Sofer says, you might have thought that, but he thinks there's a challenge, there's a twist here. Because the Ramban says on Chumash that part of the reason for Orla is that we should give the first fruits to Hashem, like Bikurim, but the first 3 years aren't worth it. It wouldn't be appropriate, because the first year, 3 years of fruits are not as good as later years. So the Ramban understands, the Torah says, first 3 years you can't do anything with it because you haven't given basically Bikurim, first fruits to Hashem yet. But these ones that are coming off aren't worth giving to Hashem because they're not good enough. So the fourth year, we take them to Yerushalayim, we eat them there. That's sort of like a Bikurim kind of an act. And then we can use them for ourselves in future years. If that's true, though, it sounds like the first 3 years, the Ramban is saying, clearly, aren't good fruit, aren't valuable, aren't the kinds of fruit that people would want. And it sounds like people think that about fruit in general. And there's a Rav in Shulchan Aruch that also thinks that, which makes it odd that the Gemara in Yevamah said that if the non-Jew claims they're from Azeka and they're from Orla, that he's lying to make it sound better. How can he make it sound better if Orla food is worse? So there's all sorts of options. One option is that even the first 3 years are generally worse. If somebody puts in a huge amount of effort, then they become not only good, but even better than regular fruit. That's one option. Another option is that he means the second year after they started producing good fruit, in which case it's not Orla at all, because he really means years, you know, 4 or 5. And then we're out of the woods with our Jew who bought this fruit, or whatever it means. But fundamentally, the Chasam Sofer thinks that we're allowed to basically ignore or reinterpret the words of the non-Jew, because what he's saying contradicts our tradition about what happened with those years and what happened with these years, and therefore we don't have to believe him, even though this non-Jew had believed him, had thought it was the second year. What really we're going to say to ourselves is that this Jew had believed him in the sense that he believed these were really, really great fruit, however you get to that. And since our tradition is you don't get to that by taking actual orla fruit, you do various things to it, or you mean the word second year in a different way, therefore he's going to allow this person to enjoy his fruit and not to worry about it. And so this person could be happy for the 8th of Tishrei of Tuf Kuf Tzaditet of 1838. And that is 3 tshuvot. That is part of how the Chasam Sofer spent his 8th of Tishrei throughout the course of his life. This is a responsible day for the 8th of Tishrei. Have a great day.